We're privileged to have Dr. Robert Baird of Baylor University speaking with us this evening. Dr. Bill Baird holds degrees from Baylor University, a bachelor's and a master's, and as well a PhD in philosophy from Emory University in Atlanta. He is a professor of philosophy and a master teacher in the philosophy department. He's editor of numerous books and author of many philosophy-related articles. I was amazed. I went and looked at his vita, and he has articles on Nietzsche, moral principles in business, leadership, Adam Smith, sexual compatibility, existentialism, the 60s, you like that one, Bob, the 60s, Hegel, Wittgenstein, and process philosophy. I mean, he is just covering all sorts of fascinating philosophical issues. Today he will be speaking on reason, commitment in the face of uncertainty. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Baird.
Well, those of you who are here for the first time, I hope this doesn't discourage you from coming back. I must say, when I walked in, I was surprised to see a couple of familiar faces, and let me say I do appreciate the invitation to be here. I did not anticipate, though, recognizing anybody, but Dr. Robert Radford is in the back. I understand this is his first visit here, but he spent his career as a philosopher at Oklahoma State. Told me he just lives 6 blocks from here, so you won't need to recruit him. Catherine Brown. Catherine, certainly known for a very long time. She taught my children, and in fact, she attended a couple of continuing education courses I did years ago, so she knows my shtick, too. So, well, disturbing. That was the way I would describe my undergraduate experience at Baylor. Disturbing, which is as it should have been, for I was being introduced to thinking, to the life of the mind, and eventually to philosophy. So bear with a little autobiography. Let me recount some of those disturbing experiences. My history professor was lecturing on Russia, the United States, and the Cold War. And after class, everyone had left. I said to this professor something that now seems to me incredibly naive. The thing is, I recall saying, the Russians know that we will not attack them, but we don't know that they'll not attack us. My unstated assumption, of course, we were the good guys, they the bad, and furthermore, everybody knew it, even them. But patiently, the professor turned to the wall and pulled a map of the world out. With this piece of chalk, he said, I'm going to put an X everywhere the United States has a missile aimed at the heart of Russia, and an X everywhere Russia has a missile aimed at us. When he finished, I stared at a map, had Russia virtually surrounded by U.S. missiles, and the United States was scarcely threatened. What a moment. What a defining moment. All of a sudden, it dawned on me, if I had been a sophomore at the University of Moscow that morning, I probably would have been petrified in the United States, terrified that the country that had already dropped the bomb on Japan might do something comparable to us. But even in that moment, I knew that the lesson I was learning had to do with much more than the Cold War. For the first time in my life, now I know, but I was really naive, but for the first time in my life, I was realizing that we see through assumptions absorbed from our environment. We see the world through colored glasses. But if our conclusions are colored by where we live, by what we're taught, by who we are, how can we be sure we have the truth? The door to critical thinking cracked open. I was also taking a course that semester in rhetoric, and in preparing a paper, I came across a speech written by a 1936 Baylor undergraduate. It began as follows. On a Sabbath morning in 1914, the great conflict, World War I, had just begun. They held a prayer service in Berlin. The Kaiser was there. The aisles were jammed. A German minister mounted the stand and, reading from the Old Testament, the account of the battle between Gideon and the Midianites and how God favored Gideon, drew across the centuries a 1914 parallel. Then they said, "Our strength is our God." Then they prayed, "God of Germany, give the victory to Germany. God of righteousness, give the victory to right." On that Sabbath morning, they held a prayer service in Paris. The war ministers were there. The aisles were packed. A French priest mounted the stand, and reading from the Old Testament the account of the battle between the Israelites and the Philistines and how God favored the Israelites, drew across the centuries the 1914 parallel. Then they said, "Our strength is our God." Then they prayed, "God of France, give the victory to France. God of righteousness, give the victory to right." On that Sabbath morning, they held their prayer service in London. The king was there. The aisles were packed. An English bishop mounted the stand, reading from the Old Testament the account of the battle between David and his enemies and how God favored David, drew across the centuries a 1914 parallel. Then they said, "Our strength is our God." Then they prayed, "God of our fathers, give England the victory. God of righteousness, give the victory to right." My sophomore's mind was reeling. The Germans see God through German eyes. The French through French eyes. The British through British eyes. And we, it seems surely to follow, see God through our own eyes, through a glass darkly, a glass well smoked by environmental and hereditary factors. But where is truth in all this? The door to critical thought opened further. In my first philosophy course, I was reading John Stuart Mill's essay on liberty. Quote, "It never troubles him," the religious dogmatist, says Mill, "it never troubles him that mere accident has decided which of these numerous worldviews is the object of his faith, and that the same causes which made him a Christian in London would have made him a Buddhist or a Confucian in Beijing. Disturbing. There it is. Those born in Buddhist cultures see reality through Buddhist eyes. Persons born in Muslim countries make pilgrimage to Mecca. Those born in Catholic families become Catholics. Those born in Baptist families, Baptist. So the question of truth and our ability to grasp it had been raised in a dramatic way. The door to critical thinking was wide open. Little side. I remember several years ago, Alice and I were in California visiting our oldest daughter at Christmas time. Our grandchildren were just the right age to be in a Christmas pageant, so we went to church with them, and lo and behold, just a classic Christmas pageant, shepherds and angels, the whole schmear. And I'm watching all this, and I'm just thinking to myself, all these little children up here, the Christian story, the Christmas story will become a part of the very fiber of their being. And then my philosophical mind gets in the gear and I'm thinking, and you know, today in India, Vishnu, Shiva, the whole Hindu story will be just a part of the very fiber of those young children as they grow. Well, eventually I came to see these educational experiences as part of the tradition going all the way back to Socrates, the gadfly, who understood his divine task as stimulating individuals to think, to evaluate critically the principles guiding their lives. And that's what my teachers were doing, stimulating me to think seriously about matters that matter. But now here's the rub. Such thinking inevitably plants, then nourishes, and finally harvests uncertainty, doubt, and ambiguity. But what are we to do with this experience of uncertainty, the anguish of doubt, the encounter with ambiguity? How should we respond to these offsprings of critical thought? Two possibilities are suggested by Fyodor Dostoevsky's underground man, the protagonist of Dostoevsky's existential notes from underground. The underground man distinguishes between persons of exaggerated consciousness and persons of direct action. Individuals of acute or exaggerated consciousness are so aware of the complexity of issues, so sensitive to the variety of arguments that can be presented for every side of a dispute, they can't choose. They're immobilized by doubt and uncertainty. They are passive intellectuals overcome by questions and ambiguity. In fact, the underground man describes himself as such an indecisive mouse. That's his phrase. Persons of direct action, by contrast, are confident individuals, bold leaders, firm decision makers. But, adds the underground man, they are confident because clueless, bold because blind, firm decision makers because they are oblivious of arguments for the opposing point of view. They act with ease, free of doubt. And while the underground man envies the ease with which they make decisions, he repeatedly notes that they are at ease precisely because they're stupid. But do these alternatives exhaust the possibilities? And intellectually inquisitive, indecisive mouse are a stupid, dogmatic, true believer? Well, surely not. And my claim, reflected in the title of this paper, is that philosophy, some notable philosophers notwithstanding, philosophy's lesson is really a middle course, a course that acknowledges uncertainty, ambiguity, and doubt, but in the face of it, encourages reason, commitment. Well, first a word about uncertainty, and then a comment about reason, commitment. When I say that philosophy plants, nourishes, and harvests doubt, I mean that it encourages the disposition to recognize that our conclusions may be mistaken. Philosophy encourages the disposition to acknowledge human finitude and fallibility. Putting it theologically, philosophy encourages the disposition to acknowledge that one isn't God. Marilynne Robinson, and some of you may know her, she is the novelist of those Gilead novels. She makes this point in an arresting way. In a recent piece in the Harvard Divinity School Bulletin entitled Credo, Robinson affirms her beliefs, her credo, but also notes that, quote, there is something about certainty that makes Christianity unchristian. Therefore, because I would be a good Christian, I have cultivated uncertainty, which I consider a form of reverence, end quote. Nevertheless, the claim that certainty is beyond the reach of fallible human beings has to be qualified, for the word certain does have a widely accepted and valuable use. For example, I might say, I'm certain that I'm now addressing you. I see you. I hear the sound of my voice. I'm confident that everyone in the room would agree that the presentation is occurring. Be a misuse of language, we might say, if I were to insist that I only think that I'm speaking or that I'm probably speaking. I mean, I have no reason whatever to doubt that I'm addressing you. So where does this leave me when I argue that philosophy plants, nourishes, and harvests doubt? And what can I mean when I suggest, as I will, that this is a good thing? When should one doubt? What are the positive consequences of such doubt and uncertainty? Well, let me try this. Since the uncertainty I'm talking about is the disposition to acknowledge that we could be mistaken, we should be uncertain when grounds for doubt have presented themselves. And a fundamental ground for such doubt is a difference of opinion among reasonable persons. When reasonable opposition presents itself, we should have doubts about the adequacy of our own view. And what I have in mind here may be more dramatic than it at first appears. For if we acknowledge that our intellectual opponent is reasonable, or even if we acknowledge that our opponent may be reasonable, that opens up the possibility that our view may be mistaken. And that realization activates uncertainty and doubt. And is there any significant issue, ranging from physician-assisted suicide to abortion, from the existence of God to what we ought to be doing in Afghanistan, from the bailout of big banks to the bailout of GM, where reasonable people do not disagree? Increased sensitivity to the fact that reasonable people do disagree, especially over religious, philosophical, political, and moral views, and that such disagreement should lead to the acknowledgement that one's own view could be mistaken. That whole awareness is what really drives much of the work of John Rawls, a contemporary philosopher in social and political thought who died in 2002. John Rawls argues that human beings face what he calls the burdens of judgment. These are reasons why, he says, we should expect reasonable people always to disagree with regard to fundamental issues. And so what is the significance of this? Recognizing these burdens and the uncertainty they generate gives birth to tolerance and mitigates against or counts against the intolerance of the fanatical true believer. I'm reminded of a moving segment from Bronowski's film series, The Ascent of Man, which surely some of you have seen. In the final scene of the film, Knowledge or Certainty, Bronowski wades out into a muddy stream at the Auschwitz prison camp. Kneeling down, he scoops a handful of mud out of the pond into which were flushed the ashes of Holocaust victims. Reflecting upon what humans do to one another when they are absolutely certain that they are right, Bronowski pleads with the film audience in the words of Oliver Cromwell, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ think it possible, you may be mistaken. That's what philosophy teaches us. We may be mistaken. But while philosophy generates this disposition to recognize that we may be mistaken, philosophy also encourages the practice, and I don't even think that's strong enough, philosophy just is the practice of giving reasons for beliefs. And this practice, giving reasons for our beliefs, would make no sense without presupposing that some views are more reasonable than others, and that to be rational is to commit oneself to those views that seem to one at the time more rational than other views. I am and always have been, said Socrates in the Crito. I am and always have been one of those natures who must be guided by reason. I must be guided, he adds, by that reason which upon reflection appears to me to be the best. Or consider John Locke's critique of innate ideas in book one of his essay concerning human understanding. What John Locke meant by innate ideas and who the object of his attack was, all of that is debatable. But one thing seems very clear as you read John Locke, and that is he is committed to the notion that inquiry should never be stopped because somebody has claimed an innate idea which has absolute certainty. According to Locke, the fundamental claim of book one of his essay concerning human understanding is that every proposition should be open to critical assessment. But at the same time, that did not preclude Locke from committing himself to what he thought, given the evidence he had at that time, what he thought was true. But here's the question. Can one doubt, because fallible, but be committed, because fully persuaded? Can you do both? Can you doubt and yet be fully committed, fully persuaded? Well, I want to argue yes, and I'll not take too long to argue this, but it does seem to me that the compatibility between the two can be understood if we think again in terms of dispositions. Doubting is the disposition to recognize that we might be mistaken. Committed, because persuaded, is the disposition to act as if our belief were true. David Brooks, some of you know the columnist of the New York Times, in a very recent essay in the Times, used the phrase, quote, detached attachment. And that's the idea. There is nothing incoherent about detached attachment. Nothing incompatible between being disposed to act and being disposed to reconsider the action if new evidence presents itself. Well, it's difficult, it seems to me, to exaggerate the importance of this philosophical lesson, that is, reason commitment in the face of ambiguity and uncertainty. For among the alternatives to this reason commitment in the face of alternatives, the face of ambiguity and uncertainty, is a pernicious relativism which maintains that one view is as good as another, which maintains that argumentation is always just power politics in disguise. In thinking about how I could make this point, and it's the last point I'm going to make here, I was reminded of a very public debate that occurred some years ago among several notable intellectuals, including Stanley Fish and George Marsden. Specifically, let me refer to Fish's criticism of Marsden. Professor Fish, some of you perhaps know him, he also frequently has material in the New York Times. Professor Fish, formerly of Duke University and the University of Illinois at Chicago, is currently at Florida International University School of Law. In an essay provocatively entitled, Why We Can't All Just Get Along, in that essay, Fish argues that fundamental commitments are just arbitrary. He goes so far as to say that people of religious conviction, and now I'm reading a paragraph for you, people of religious conviction should not want to enter the marketplace of ideas, but to shut it down, at least insofar as it presumes to determine matters that he believes to have been determined by God and faith. The religious person should not seek an accommodation with liberalism. And here, liberalism refers to the view that positions ought to be explored and defended in the marketplace. But religious people, he argues, should not enter a marketplace of ideas, but try to shut it down, should try to rout, extirpate the whole enterprise of giving reasons for one's point of view. In fact, Fish sees civility, tolerance, and freedom. Think of those three words. Civility, tolerance, and freedom. At one point, he refers to those as the holy trinity of liberalism. And he denigrates all three of them. They're incompatible, he says, with a serious profession of religious faith, or apparently is incompatible with any serious commitment. Since basic commitments are arbitrary and beyond rational analysis, intolerance supported by political power is the game to play. Consider specifically now Fish's response to Morrison, who wrote a very important work entitled Soul of the American University. Morrison affirms the notion of procedural rationality in the marketplace of ideas. And he distinguishes, Morrison does, between religious viewpoints that willingly operate within these procedural rules by honoring some basic rules of evidence and argument, and those that are presented so dogmatically and aggressively as not to be accommodated within the procedural rules of a pluralistic academia. For advancing this philosophical commitment to reason, Marsden is accused by Fish of sacrificing his Christian faith to the religion of civility. Fish's version of postmodern relativism comes close to rejecting the heart of philosophy. The commitment to reason belief, to rationality as the way to proceed in human affairs, which I'm saying is the heart of philosophy, is what Fish rejects. Now, I'm almost through. The term rational is, of course, complex and problematic. But let me call attention to two of its meanings. Rationality in the Socratic sense is commitment to the notion that beliefs ought to be open to public evaluation. Consider Jeffrey Stout's definition of rational. Quote, what you're being when you take all relevant considerations, all evidence and argumentation into account, and exhibit all the appropriate intellectual virtues. Or Martha Nussbaum, to be rational is to find an account that can endure critical scrutiny. Or Robert Nozick, to be rational is to recognize that the acceptability of a belief is connected with a dense network of reasoning and inference drawing. Rationality in this sense is just what I'm thinking of as philosophy's basic lesson. Well, Harold Attridge, who at the time was Dean of the College of Arts and Letters at Notre Dame, described the identity of Notre Dame is growing out of two paradigmatic narratives. This is my last paragraph here. the two paradigmatic narratives were the story of Jesus and the story of Socrates. The latter, the Socrates story, says Attridge has defined for 24 centuries the essential component of the life of the mind, to wit, the ability to give a reasoned basis for belief. And of course, what I've been arguing here is that philosophy's lesson is encouragement of us to commit ourselves reasonably, even in the face of ambiguity and uncertainty, if at the time we've got evidence to make those commitments. So what I've really attempted to do here is really just to flesh out a claim Bertrand Russell made years ago in the introduction to his History of Western Philosophy. Here's his statement. I remember the first time I read it as an undergraduate, it grabbed my imagination and has never left. To teach how to live without certainty and yet without being paralyzed by hesitation is perhaps the chief thing that philosophy in our age can do for those who study. I'd add one sentence. There is something compelling about the fact that especially in those areas of life where values are involved, one must make uncertain judgments and then act courageously. That just is the fundamental lesson of philosophy.
Again, with the questioning, I want to recognize your wife, Alice Baird. She's the book came up all the way up from Waco, so let's recognize her. So I'll open up the floor to questions for Dr. Baird. Yes, Ken.
Just how important is evidence in coming up with a rational basis for belief? And how firm can you be about evidence?
There is a big debate that goes on over the following claim, a claim which I'm committed to. But the claim suggests that it is wrong always to commit yourself to a point of view for which you have no evidence whatsoever. And it just seems to me that that is a point of view I want to adopt and a point of view we all ought to adopt. Because if you don't acknowledge that there is some kind of evidence, now, what counts as evidence? We even have disagreement about what counts as evidence, how much evidence one ought to have in order to justify holding a point of view. But if you don't acknowledge that evidence of some kind is relevant to the beliefs that we hold, then there is no way to make discriminations between one point of view and another. And it does seem to me that what we all want to do is to suggest that there has to be some way to discriminate between position A and B. And the only way it seems to me that one can go about making that discrimination is just to see which point of view has the most evidence in its favor. Now, my students and I have a lot of conversation about this, and one point I frequently do make to students is that controversial issues are controversial precisely because there are good arguments for both points of view. And if you think the evidence is in favor of A rather than B, you don't have to maintain that there are no arguments whatsoever in defense of B. I mean, you can certainly recognize that there are some powerful arguments in defense of B, but you just at this point have concluded that most of the evidence is in defense of A. Yeah, so I mean, I just think evidence is crucial in our ability to make distinctions between the various beliefs that are open to us. And without evidence, it seems to me there is no way to maintain that one point of view is any better than another point of view. And I just don't think anybody really wants to acknowledge that. I don't think anybody wants to say, yeah, every point of view is as good as any other point of view. Yes.
How would you say your arguments fit in with Aristotle's idea of the gold key? Or is that a valid question?
Yeah, no, that's a legitimate question. And I think, I mean, what Aristotle, it seems to me, is providing a big argument and trying to provide some evidence. And what Aristotle, it seems to me, is suggesting is that if we look at how people are living their lives, we will discover that people are living their lives more successfully. They are realizing their possibilities and potentialities better if they live their life as a mean between extremes. So I think what Aristotle, in effect, is doing is observing how people live their lives, and he thinks that he can provide plenty of empirical evidence, really, that people who live their life as a means between extremes are people who live more successful lives. And so it's better to be prudent than to be a coward or foolhardy. And so he provides all of these little pieces of evidence that suggest a life lived as a mean between extremes is a more successful life.
I'd like to just go back to the evidence question. You seem to be saying most or more, and I asked, are you really referring to the volume or quantity of evidence? What if someone agrees that there is evidence on both sides, however, the quality of my evidence, because based on my values, makes my decision.
Okay. That's a great question. And that leads me to say that I think one of the most important pieces of material, John Rawls' discussion of the burdens that fall on us when it comes to the arguments that we find ourselves involved in. Because when he talks about the burdens of judgment, what he wants to say is, the evidence for two points of view is often ambiguous, but really what is more difficult than that is that when the arguments or the evidence is presented, you've got to interpret that evidence and I've got to interpret that evidence, and the value commitments that you already bring to the table have an impact on how you interpret the evidence, and it impacts on how I interpret the evidence, and that's just one of the reasons why you and I have so much difficulty agreeing. I mean, that's part of the difficulty of the human situation, because our evaluating the evidence depends so often on value judgments that we already bring to the enterprise.
So if we agree to disagree, does that mean that it leaves us to no action?
Well, what it does, it seems to me, if we agree to disagree, it can mean several things. It can mean you don't shoot me and I don't shoot you. I mean that's one very important consequence of all of this. Now, it also means, though, that you may behave in one way and I may behave in another. And so with regard to Proposition 8 in California, it may mean that you're out on the streets defending one point of view with regard to Prop 8, and I'm out on the streets defending another. So it doesn't mean that we don't act given the commitments we've made. But it also means that hopefully we will recognize part of what I'm trying to argue tonight, and that is that I recognize you as a reasonable person, and I hope you recognize me as one, and that means I cannot be absolutely certain that I'm right and you're wrong, though I may think the evidence right now supports me, and so I'm going to defend my point of view, but I'm going to do it in a way that leaves you room in the marketplace to defend your point.
It seems like that the worldview that you are most nearly opposed to, there's not much room for agreement, is the worldview of radical skepticism to our fields. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah. Well, what do I want to say about that? It does seem to me that radical skepticism is really, in a sense, self-defeating. Because the radical skeptic says, there is something I know. We cannot know anything. And so it does seem to me that radical skepticism is logically self-defeating. But beyond that, the truth of the matter is, I don't think anybody lives their life that way. I just don't think anybody lives their life in such a way that they don't believe some things are true and some things are false. And consequently, that has an impact on the way life is lived. So, with regard to nihilism, if we mean by nihilism the claim that there are no values, then again, it seems to me everybody lives their life as if there were some values. And if you follow an individual around, you will discover that that individual does have some values and it structures the way the individual lives his or her life. Now, it could be that one could mean by a nihilist, not that one doesn't believe there are some values, but just believes that there's no way ever to give any reasons in defense of one's values. That's another point of view.
Yeah, I like the way you pointed out that war is essentially a religious ritual. And, there are no atheists in the foxholes. It says a lot about the benefits of being rational, and that in order to conquer human rationality, you can take boot camp or Bible college, and or the Taliban schools or what have you. But, Aristotle professes to follow this middle way between the two, and didn't he teach Alexander how to conquer the world using that? I mean, are you in favor of war or not?
Who am I? First of all, I'm not at all sure I would want to say that what Aristotle was up to when he was teaching Alexander was teaching him about war. Alexander the Great set himself to conquer the world and conquered most of it. I'm not sure how much we want to attribute that to what Aristotle was teaching him. What do I want to say about war? I don't know. Ultimately, it seems to me, as you pursue that issue, you eventually are asking the question, are you a pacifist or not? And though there was a time in my life when I was very young and skirted with pacifism, I don't think that's something that I would be willing to philosophically defend. So, to the extent that I am not a pacifist, I suppose to that extent I would have to acknowledge that there is such a thing as just war. So, if Hitler is doing what Hitler was up to, it seems to me that there's some justification for trying to see that Hitler doesn't continue to do what he was up to.
Yes, I want to ask you a question, such a personal about your life. If Baylor can teach this message, and let's say my assumption, the question is going to be that most students that come to you, your faculty, your peers, academic peers, believe in some sort of moral absolutes and some sort of certainty about right and wrong. And if that's true, how's your message received in the classroom and among your peers?
Well, Well, it is true that my introductory philosophy course, and I'm now completing my 43rd year at Baylor, my introductory philosophy course probably has something like this as the guiding thesis in that course. And I have certainly found students over the years to be receptive to the kind of arguments I advance, and I certainly have found a lot of support among my colleagues. I sometimes do think there are some misperceptions about what Baylor University is about down there. Now, it is certainly true that I have had some pretty intense disagreements with especially one president of Baylor University. And that had more to do with what I thought were infringements on academic freedom and faculty governance, which certainly would be related to that. But I will say this. I've been teaching at Baylor for 43 years. I never, for a moment, had anybody there even suggest interrupting what I was doing in my classroom. Yeah. Robert, right.
I wanted to push a little bit on that.
And Robert's a Baylor graduate, so he can talk about his undergraduate.
Yeah, I got crushed there, too.
Yeah. Now I'm going to be in trouble with my colleague back here. Yeah, Robert.
You suggested that the controversial issues typically have fairly strong reasons on both sides. I think I can see that with maybe abortion, euthanasia, capital punishment, war. Strikes me there are some issues in which there are sharp controversies in our public life. But that's not the case, where you have fairly strong informed views on one side, and you have a lot of cultural attitudes and emotions and fabricated claims on the other side. One example of which I've been blogging on lately has to do with the immigration issue. Is that even fair that some controversies?
I do think that's fair. And let me just get an issue out on the table here, which may not go down well with many of you. I just don't know where your views are. But I think, for example, I think with regard to gay and lesbian rights, I have some very strong views with regard to that. I do think that those who have opposed me with regard to that have some arguments that I have to take into account. But I also think, now this is from my perspective, I also think that there's a lot of misinformation, I think, that gets propagated with regard to that issue. And so I would certainly agree. And let me say, this is, I think, relevant. The other day, I read a comment. I'm not even going to mention who the political figure is. But I read a comment about a political figure who publicly made a statement that he knew was not true. And there's evidence that he knew it wasn't true, but he uttered that statement for political gain. And it seems to me that what we frequently discover is there really is a lack of integrity with regard to public debate. And that's a matter that bothers me a whole lot. Now, you know, of course, somebody can quickly say, well, you see it sometimes as a matter of integrity because you find somebody advancing a position you disagree with. But I think it's true, Robert. I think we can certainly see times that individuals, for a variety of motives, are not playing the intellectual game fairly. That is, they're not really advancing arguments. They are, for their own particular reasons, trying to mislead people for their own gain. I certainly think that's true. Yeah.
I've known a number of people and colleagues whose
claim that they make rational decisions. I'm a psychologist, and as I know them, I see a great deal of emotionality in their decision making.
Sure.
Do you recognize the place of the feelings and emotions in valid decision making as well as rationality?
Well, I thought you were going to go in a different direction, so let me distinguish between a couple of issues here. I mean, what you're finally asking, I think, is whether or not we think of emotions as really having a cognitive role. Can emotions really enable us to see some things that otherwise we have not seen? And this is controversial, but I think, in fact, that's right, that our emotions sometimes enable us to see some things that otherwise we wouldn't see. Another dimension, it seems to me, is to what extent are the decisions we make made for reasons we're not even aware of? And I think that's true, too. I mean, if I take off my coat, my tendency is to roll my sleeves up a couple of my... Alice used to ask me, why do you do that? You look fine with your, you know, your... Well, I don't know. I just roll them up. I don't know. One day, I walked through our den, and I glanced up at the TV, and there was an old movie on. And I looked up, and I saw something, and all of a sudden, matters became very clear to me. It was a movie with Gene Kelly in this movie. When I was a kid, I thought Gene Kelly was just unbelievable. If you think about Gene Kelly, 99% of the time he had his cuffs rolled up. All of these routines, dance routines, he had his cuffs rolled up. All of a sudden I'm looking up there and I'm thinking, I've been rolling my cuffs up for 30, 40 years because of a childhood identification with Gene. So, I mean, I think there are all sorts of things that do go into the decision-making process that we frequently are not aware of. And that just complicates the whole thing further. I mean, it's very complicated, right?
Okay, so that brings you to, does reasonable include emotion?
Well, yeah, see, and you can distinguish between reason and emotion, but there are a lot of philosophers who maintain that we get into a lot of difficulty with all these distinctions we make, as if reason and feelings are something altogether separate. So that's part of the problem, is somehow maybe thinking of ourselves as whole beings and not just seeing us as, well, on Monday I'm rational, on Tuesday I'm emotional. The truth of the matter is we are responding as a whole person, and it may be misleading to somehow try to divide even reason from
it. Okay, you have this
question back here. Next question back here.
Somebody had a question.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
You make this, I believe it's an assumption, right, that a reasonable person accepts and trusts that the other person is reasonable as well when they allow for the we agree that we disagree.
Yeah, well we hope that when we engage in conversation, I mean, the ideal is that both parties are being reasonable. I'm not suggesting, and to go back to the point that Robert was making a moment ago, I'm not suggesting, sometimes we're involved in a debate with somebody and we're saying under our breath, this so-and-so, he's not paying any attention to reasons at all. So, I mean, sometimes
we... We'll move to the whole, taking the whole issue, a holistic issue. Emotions come into it, politics come into it, etc. It seems to be more critical than reason. You're saying you allow for fallibility.
Well, yeah, what I want to emphasize there is that because we are all fallible, we could be mistaken. And because we could be mistaken, we ought to be more open and tolerant to examining the evidence that other people are presenting to us when they are in conflict with us. But see, on the other hand, I want to say that should not result, though, in this underground man's indecisive mouse who's never willing then to make a judgment or make a decision or act. Yeah. But it's an action that always recognizes that down the pike I may have to change my mind if I discover that the evidence for the alternative point of view is really more adequate than the evidence that I have. That
last question, yes. Bob Berman.
It would seem to me, in studying the whole history of philosophy, that the real problem here is determining valid evidence as opposed to invalid evidence. The whole field of epistemology, trying to determine what is valid evidence and what is not. And just presenting, you know, the other guy's got a different view from mine, he's got his evidence, I got my evidence, but some evidence is better than other types of evidence. It depends on how you define it and how you get it. And that's the most basic problem.
There is a little section of this paper that I omitted. At one point, I distinguish between rationality in two different senses. The sense of rationality in which I talked about it here, you're being rational if you are willing to enter the marketplace of ideas and just consider arguments pro and con of position. I mean, that's one sense of rationality. You're being rational if you really take into account evidence and argumentation. But there is another sense of rationality, and that is, what are the canons of rationality that govern, let's say, science? What are the canons of rationality that govern legal conversations? Are the canons of rationality that govern moral conversations? And those change because we disagree about those. So you're right, there's a lot of disagreement about what really counts as evidence in science or in the and over time, we do change our perspectives on what counts as evidence in various disciplines. But even that change occurs because we're being rational in that first sense. That is, we're willing to examine matters in the market.
I was referring to logic versus empiricism. Say you talk about reason. I never heard anything about evidence on the empirical side.
Okay. Well, I certainly intended that, though. I mean, when I talk about arguments or evidence, yeah, I really didn't intend to be comprehensive to talk about logical inference drawing, but also to talk about empirical evidence. I think, for example, that when Aristotle began to talk about the mean between extremes, that was rooted in his empirical awareness of how people were living their lives and what sort of lives seemed to be most productive and which sort of lives seemed to be not very productive. That kind of empirical, yeah.
Let's give another round of applause.